There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, a roundup of the best bits from today's show from Sunday, February the 2nd.
Let's get some more on that top story, of course, the coronavirus and its continued impact on the global economy, indeed the regional and local economy. Khatija Haque is head of MENA research at Emirates NBD, obviously following this one closely. So we spoke to Khatija and we've been asking whether all of the information is now priced into the markets. We had a big sell-off late last week, or is it still going to be the big story driving markets this week as well?
The coronavirus story will probably continue to impact markets in the near term, as there's no sign of it being contained. In fact, we've had over the weekend more countries restricting travel to China. We've also had Apple announcing that it would close all its stores in China for a week. And we've continued to see downgrades from the global investment banks in terms of their forecast for Chinese GDP growth this year. Now, that clearly will have a knock-on impact on a number of asset classes, notably oil, because China is a huge consumer of oil. So if there's concern about slower growth and weak demand, then that clearly is negative for oil prices. But also it would have a negative impact on global trade volumes, on supply chains, and that poses a downside risk to global growth as well. So I think we will continue to see markets try and price this uncertainty. But given that we don't really know how long it's going to continue for, it's very difficult to say how much further markets still have to price it. So we really need to get a handle on some idea of when it's under control and when normal business can resume before you can start to measure the overall impact. In the meantime, the People's Bank of China have announced that they will ensure that there is sufficient liquidity in the banking system. They have encouraged banks not to call in loans that may have fallen due over the last few days. And certainly they will make provision to make sure that there's cash in the system, either through lower borrowing costs or making more funding available in other ways.
It's Khatija Haque of Emirates NBD. We've also been getting some insight on this from Aaron Leslie John. Now, he's the chief market analyst at the brokerage Century Financial here in Dubai, talking about a couple of assets in particular. First of all, the oil price, which one of our headlines had its worst start to the year since 1991.
China is one of the largest consumers of oil. Chinese oil demand is expected to come down by about 3 to 4 million barrels per week, not per day, per week. So in spite of the OPEC output cuts, we could see a surplus scenario in the oil markets, at least in the next 1 month.
What about what happens next on the markets? This is what he said.
Fear still dominates the markets, so we are expecting a sell-off. The markets have not seen a correction for quite a long time. As you all know, the only comparable scenario is SARS virus. In that particular year, Chinese GDP had taken a hit of approximately 1%. Maybe we could take a similar hit this year, but we expect the impact to be contained.
That's Aaron John of Century Financial.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
The DIFC's new employment benefits scheme has gone live. We are very pleased to be joined in the studio now by the Free Zone's Chief Legal Officer, Jacques-Jean Visser. It's lovely to have you, Jacques. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys, and thanks for having me.
Do you want to talk us through the very basics of how DUES, the DIFC Employment Workplace Savings Plan, actually works?
Sure. So if you look at the basic features, I think the first thing to notice is the levels of oversight and regulation. You basically have at the top end a supervisory board, which has representation of DIFC, it has representation of employer and employee representatives, and it also has room for an independent chairman, which means this scheme is not being controlled by DIFC, it's actually being controlled by the employees and the independent. So that's just at the top level, an oversight function that can hire and fire services providers depending on their performance. Then below that, every single service is provided to the scheme, essentially the master trustee, the administrator, or the investment advisor. Those are all regulated services providers. So that's sort of the first thing. that you need to be mindful of in a scheme of this nature, because ultimately it's people's retirement money. And as a consequence, that those levels of oversight are very important. On the basics, it's a contribution into a monthly savings plan. Those are owned by the trustee on behalf of the employees as beneficiaries. It's administered by an administrator, and then there's an investment advisor that decides where that money goes.
So basically, instead of your end of service benefits coming out of the company's cash flow or the company's savings account, it's coming out of a special investment account where it has hopefully been doing some good. Why did we need a new system?
Well, the shortfalls of the current system that you still find in the rest of the country are very well known, very well publicized. The World Bank came out with the DED in 2012, pointing to the shortcomings. But the basic thing is that the gratuity payment scheme, the lump sum at end of service, is essentially designed for a short-term labor force. People that come in for 2 to 5 years, they get a bit of a handshake when they leave, and that's it. It was never meant to be savings towards somebody's retirement. Now we see the demographic of employees in the country, and they stay for much, much longer. And even if they own property here, they may actually retire here. So with that demographic changing, you also need to rethink the way that people need to save towards their retirement.
How have you calculated the contributions that employers are making?
The 5.83% for employees below 5 years of service and the 8.33% above that are essentially the monthly contribution equivalent of the 21 days under the old scheme and the 30 days under the old scheme. It comes down to the same thing.
But this money is being invested in low risk, medium risk, high risk investments. Does that mean that DIFC employees are going to end up with more money than if they were working onshore?
We would certainly hope so, and that's the idea, and that's what you see elsewhere in the world. If you look at the default profile, the low moderate profile, that the money will go in automatically if people don't choose anything else, the projected return on that is between 4 to 5% per annum. So if you take that over a long term basis, then people will get over 5 years or 10 years, a much higher return on their money than what they would have gotten in terms of salary increases.
But we also know that investments can go south as well. How are you ensuring that money is invested safely?
Well, that comes back to the levels of oversight and regulation in the first place. And I think as markets move in the short term, people should not be concerned. This is a long-term savings plan, and as a consequence, those projected returns should also be looked at from a long-term perspective.
Employees have a couple of options here. They have the options as to what risk profile to have for themselves. How are you going to make sure, or is it even your job to make sure, that they make sensible decisions on that?
It's not our job, but we've made very sure. If you go to the website now that Zurich, the administrator, has set up, the amount of educational material out there and the outreach that we've done and the sessions that we've done with employers, it's very important for us that people make sensible and informed decisions and also take advice. If they want to move away from the default scheme, well, they can go low, which is essentially cash, then there's no risk. But if they wanted to go higher than the default, we would advise them to take advice. But if you look at the educational material already out there, and this is also in other parts of the world where employers play a role, where they educate their employees to make sensible decisions.
And employees as well can put money into this. They can put some of their own savings into that. Are there any caveats or caps around that?
The only cap is that they can't pay in more than what they get from their employers, i.e. they can't put in outside money.
I couldn't come along with $500,000 that I've been carefully squirreling away under my mattress and thinking, the returns here look good, I'll put my savings in as well.
If the trustee and the administrator can properly verify the proceeds, where that money is coming from, they can, under the rules, accept it. But generally, they will only take contributions up to the amount of your salary and bonuses, because then they know exactly where the money is coming from.
We're getting a load of questions in for Jacques this morning, the Chief Legal Officer of DIFC. I'm going to throw one at you now. Do DIFC employees have the chance to opt out? Could they go back to the old gratuity system if they want to?
The short answer is no. The days of unfunded lump sum end of service payments in the DIFC are essentially over. Having said that, they don't necessarily have to contribute into the dues plan. If you go to the employment law, the regime that's been put in place is essentially a qualifying scheme regime, i.e. If you meet all the requirements in terms of regulation and oversight and all the protections, then alternative schemes can come in, and we already have one that's applied. So there will be a choice. So they can opt out of dues, which is the default plan, but employers can't say, I don't want to make any contributions.
Can an employee withdraw from the investment fund, from the scheme, before they leave their company?
Yes and no. Whatever they save themselves into the scheme on a voluntary basis, they can withdraw at any time. There's no lockup. Whatever their employer contributes, they can only access when they leave service. But they don't have to. When they leave service, they can actually leave that money in for however long they want to before withdrawing it.
What happens to the gratuity that someone has already earned? Someone's messaging with an example, if I've been working for 10 years for the same employer, now this new scheme comes in, what happens?
So from a legislative perspective, that stays in place as is. So whenever a person leaves their employment, say 5 years from now, whatever has accrued up to the 31st of January is just payable to them by the employer, at whatever the termination salary is. So there's no obligation on employers to fund that contribution into dues, but obviously the legislation makes provision that they can. And if they do so with employees' consent, they basically, their obligation to make that gratuity payment goes away. If they don't have employee consent, they can still pay it in and basically get the upside themselves.
What about fees? What kind of fees are being levied on these investments and who pays them?
So there's an annual management fee of 1.26 to 1.33%, depending on what option you choose on the risk profile. But you have to see that in the context of this is a one-off fee. There's no membership fees. There's no changing fees. There's no fees for coming in, coming out. It's a one-off annual fee. And that came about from first a global benchmarking exercise where professional advisors went out globally, had a look and came in with a range between 1 to 5 and 1.5. And they're a very, very fierce competitive bidding process to come in that low, essentially.
Are you happy with those fees, though? I mean, I know if we look at some of the robo-advisors and the rest of it are offering fees of under 1%. We know that UAE expats pay some of the highest fees for their investment vehicles in the world.
So as a starting point, we're very, very happy with the fees because they came in at the low end of the global benchmark. To give you an example, as we stand now, Nest, a similar scheme in the UK, is still charging 1.8% for any new money coming in. So it's very low if you look at all the layers of oversight and regulation and the cost of compliance that comes with that. Having said that, there's a duty being placed on the trustee that within the first 2 years, because typically there's an establishment phase where this thing ramps up and you get assets under management and you get a better understanding of what the scale of the whole thing is. So there's a duty placed on the trustee to, within the first 2 years, do a value for money assessment. And then our expectation is that the fees will come down quite extensively.
Scott's asking what happens with Americans. They obviously have regulations about who they can invest in, SEC compliant funds. Is that being provided for American employees?
Yes, there is under the employment regulations room to ask for exemptions under Regulation 2.17. And if you're under a statutory duty to make a contribution into a scheme elsewhere as an employer, such as a 401k scheme or an IRA scheme in the US, you will be exempted from this.
Adam wants to know whether the contributions are capital protected, are principal protected, if the basic gratuity equivalent is guaranteed.
The basic principle is that it's money put in a savings plan where you then decide on the risk profile. So if you decide to put the money in cash, unless you go into negative yield territory, it's pretty much capital guaranteed. But at the same time, if you look at the yields on a cash-only investment, then our view is that it won't keep track with inflation and it won't keep track with salary increases. So if you want to show a decent return on your money for retirement purposes, as is the case everywhere else in the world, that money will be placed at risk. But that risk you have to see in the context of global passively managed index funds that have very low volatility and very low risk in any event.
Is it not the case, though, that in a lot of places people can choose whether or not to take the gratuity or the pension, whatever is better off?
In this case, as I said, there's room for exemptions and there's room for qualifying alternative schemes. But ultimately, in the DIFC, the obligation to make some contribution to some savings plan is a mandatory one.
Will non-DIFC companies be allowed or be able to use this scheme if they have a look at it and think, do you know what, I really, really like that? Is there a provision for them to get involved?
So as a starting point, and you have to understand that this is, you know, the first time this has been done in the region. So as a starting point, it's basically as an obligatory scheme, it's put there for DIFC employers to make their contributions into. They already have the option under the current regime to opt in their employees that are not in the DIFC. So if you're a bank and you have employees in DIFC and also outside, they can opt in. The what happens next will essentially require a change of the rules to allow in companies from elsewhere. But that is definitely something that will be on the cards in the next year.
Which is the million dirham question, isn't it? I mean, you're starting with this in the DIFC. Are there discussions at the moment for other free zones to do this or something similar, or even onshore in general? Could we see the entire gratuity system disappear?
So the shortcomings that we as DIFC have identified in terms of the end of service gratuity scheme, that applies to the whole of the country. And as a consequence, there's a fair amount of interest and has been over the past 3 years. Whilst we were designing the scheme and on the working group methodology spoke to all of these people, there's a fair amount of interest. Now that we've actually gone ahead and done it, that level of interest has actually gone up, and there are discussions with other government entities and bodies outside of the DIFC to extrapolate this into the rest of the country.
Thank you very much for joining us on the Business Breakfast this morning. Jacques Jeanvisse is the Chief Legal Officer at the DIFC, which has, of course, just introduced its new employee benefits scheme, its workplace savings plan. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
Starting with this woman.
When there's more money in your hand and you, the person who has it, will be better in a position to decide where you want to save instead of me directing it. So I'm allowing you to have more money in your hand and depend on your judgment where you want to place your savings.
That's Nirmala Sitharaman, Indian Finance Minister. Busy day for her yesterday. The Indian federal budget was announced. Special trading day on Mumbai stock exchanges yesterday because of that budget. Now, she's injecting $40 billion into, in particular, the farm sector. She says farmers need more money. Also, a federal water scheme. She's cutting some taxes. She mentioned that there. She wants to put money in the hands of people. So income taxes are being streamlined. which is all well and good to boost the economy because it's down at 5% or so a year economic growth, which isn't very, very much. However, there have been warnings, and two in particular. One, the stock market says it doesn't go far enough, which is why there was a sell-off yesterday. Mumbai down about, Sensex down more than 2% yesterday. But Moody's, the ratings agency, is really worried about who's going to pay for all of this. Moody's saying it's going to see the budget deficit go from about 3%, where the target is, to 4%. And that's a concern. Every finance minister who ever lived wants to stand up when delivering their budget and go, tax cuts and more spending. There's not a finance minister alive who doesn't want to do that. But you got to pay for it. Now, Moody's isn't adjusting their rating yet. It's not a disaster yet. But they say this is not a free lunch. Somebody's got to pay for it. The people who are going to pay for it is the debt market. If you take more debt, that makes it more expensive. The interest rate's going to go up. So Moody's a little bit concerned about that. A little bit later on today, we're going to get more on this. We're going to be crossing live to Mumbai in about half an hour's time, talking to an economist for their quick take on what that means. Also this morning, my newsmaker is this person.
From the moment she was a little girl, Sophia Kennan believed that this may be her destiny.
Producer Shruti Rajendra is with us in the studio. Morning, Shruti.
Morning.
Who was that?
That is Sophia Kennan. She is the 21-year-old American woman who is now the Australian Open champion. She beat Garbine Muguruza yesterday, 4-6, 6-2, 6-2. And like I said, she's 21. She's the youngest woman champion at the Australian Open since Maria Sharapova in 2008. And she's also the youngest American to win a Grand Slam women's singles title since Serena Williams in 2002.
Which is all very nice, but it wouldn't normally have piqued my attention. I mean, she's interesting, fine, but of the last 12 women's Grand Slams, 8 of them have been won by first-time champions. Mm. So it's nothing new for a new star to break onto the tennis scene. The reason that this is such an incredible story is that she's been a star in the United States for the past 15 years, and she's 21. Do the maths. She was identified as a child prodigy at the age of 5. Have a listen to this. This is an American TV program called Inside Tennis when she was just 7 years old, so 14 years ago.
At age 7, it is hard to guarantee who is going to be a champion. However, Rick Macy coach Sonia Kennan appears to have what is needed to get to the top. Why do you want to be a tennis pro?
Because I want to be a champion and I want to be number one in the world.
How much are you practicing? How long are you on the tennis court every day?
3 hours.
3 hours every day.
3 hours a day. Wow. At the age of 7.
That's incredible, isn't it?
And this weekend, she won her first Grand Slam, the Australian Open. What do we know about this person?
So she is like Maria Sharapova, born in Russia, moved to America when she was about 3 years old. Her father was actually a taxi driver. And then she started playing in her backyard with her dad, you know, just sort of hitting the tennis balls, and then got picked up by a famous coach. And
out of her backyard?
No, when she started going for training, because it's Florida. Florida is, you know, the place to go if you want to improve your tennis, I would say. And that's where she got noticed first. And, you know, she started, she entered the US, the United States Tennis Association's young champions Grand Slams. And she started playing and she got noticed by Kim Clijsters, you know, the Belgian superstar. And she actually said that, you know, I think she's going to be one of the big names in the future. And so it started from there. She's, you know, sort of gained, you know, a name for herself. But her father actually said that because of Coco Gauff, who is a 17-year-old, the focus on other American players is not there. So he would like if Sophia Kennan got as much attention as Coco Gauff. And now, you know, she's gone on to win the Australian Open.
What do we know? How good is she? She was ranked 14 in the world before this tournament. So she was clearly one of the world's top players. You're a big tennis fan. You've watched her play.
Yes.
How good is she?
She's really good. And, you know, there was a stat on Twitter, I think, the other day that said in the past 10 or 12 years, there have been no new men Grand Slam winners. It's always been the top three. It's always been Roger Federer, Rafa Nadal, Novak Djokovic. But if you look at the women's, you've got Ashley Barty, you've got Sophia Kennan, you've got Bianca Andreescu. You know, it's up and coming talent. So that just shows how much women's tennis, you know, the depth of growth, the talents that are coming up. And it's just incredible to see these young talents coming up.
Final question on this. Is the women's tennis getting the coverage it deserves now? Because the debate has raged, hasn't it, about equivalency of pay within the tennis world and whether or not women's tournaments get as many people turning up to buy tickets or watching on television. What do we know about that?
Yeah, I would say because of these big names or these up-and-coming big names, you know, your young stars who are bringing something fresh and new, injecting this new sort of energy into tennis, I think it is becoming more famous. You know, when even if you look down to the French Open with Ashleigh Barty, US Open with Bianca Andreescu, and now the Australian Open with Sofia Kenin, it's these young stars who are bringing something new. It's not just watching Serena Williams. It's not just watching Maria Sharapova, Victoria Azarenka, and so on. So in a way, it's quite refreshing to see this. And I think they're so young and new and exciting that it is drawing the attention. But I think men still sort of pips it a little bit more, because no matter what you say, watching Roger Federer, you know, in Melbourne, it's still going to draw the crowds.
I'm looking at the lineup for the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championships, which start in a couple of weeks' time, to see if she's in the lineup. I know Ashleigh Barty's coming. She's the women's world number one, one of the top players. Do we know if she's coming?
Not that I know of, but I do think Coco Gauff is meant to be one of the people coming here.
We shall be covering that one in some detail. Brandy Scott, your newsmaker today is the Prague landlord.
Yes, it is. The city of Prague. Prague cracking down on Airbnb in a concerted effort to give Prague back to the people of Prague. Those are the words of the mayor of Prague, Zdeněk Hrib, from the excellently named Pirate Party, who is basically giving Airbnb a huge headache. Here's what they've done. They have changed the rules for Airbnb. And to be fair, a lot of cities have got their own rules. We've got our own rules for Airbnb to reflect the concerns of the city in which it is operating. And in Prague, they are worried about the amount of people coming to Prague. They get 8 million tourists a year, population 1.3 million. So they're feeling extremely outnumbered. They are also concerned about the amount of tourists and the impact on residential neighbourhoods, people trolling through suburbs at all hours of the morning with wheelie suitcases loudly on cobblestones, and obviously pricing locals out of the market. It costs 14 years of annual salary, I think, to buy a flat in the city of Prague.
How many months?
14 years.
14 years of salary, okay.
14 times the annual salary.
And the global average, the rule of thumb is 3 or 4, isn't it?
So they're saying, look, we're being priced out of the market. It's noisy, it's disturbing. And the other thing is tax, because a lot of people who own the Airbnbs in Prague don't necessarily live in Prague, and so therefore aren't paying the local tax, which would pay for all the infrastructure that the tourists are using. To quote the mayor, he said, it's not fitting in with the idea of the shared economy. The shared economy was the idea that you had someone stay in your home, maybe you cooked them breakfast, you told them, you know, where to go and check out our see if it's a great district, whatever it happens to be. He said, what we have actually got here is a distributed hotel across the city. The whole city's turned into a hotel, and it's not going to happen anymore. So the new rules are that you can only rent out an entire apartment, a whole apartment, if it's your own residence and you leave while the person is there.
You're kidding me.
So basically, you can't buy something just to be an Airbnb if you're not living in it. Otherwise, you have to rent out single rooms within your property.
That's a bombshell.
It is indeed.
For a city for which tourism is such a major part of the economy.
Yep, they've said, look, beforehand, we had a control over the number of tourists coming in because you could control the number of hotels that were built and how many room keys there were. Do you know what I mean? And that's a tool, if you like, that local governments have. He said, we don't have that control anymore. We have no capacity to limit how many people are staying in Airbnbs and therefore how many tourists we have in. So this is how we take back control.
Strikes me as a bad idea. You?
I don't love it because a lot of people, for safety reasons, will not want to stay in a room in someone else's home. And I put myself in that category. I don't do that. I don't like it. Makes me uncomfortable. Small talk, running into someone else while you're going to the loo in the middle of the night. Not happy. Not happy in the slightest. I only ever rent places that are entirely my own and that I can sort of, you know, lock from the inside and put a chain on, to be honest. But I can also understand if you are being inundated with tourists and you think it's having a detrimental effect on your own people buying into the property market. Yeah, can see why they're doing it.
I can confirm that the new Australian Open champion will be at the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championships this year. Sofia Kenin has been confirmed, along with world number one, Ashley Barty, world number two, Caroline Pliskova, and world number three, Simona Halep. Looking forward to that lineup tremendously.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We're talking the business of books.
I love reading books, it's fun. I often read them with my mum. I like reading to explore. There's no better way, I'm sure. I love reading.
Well, we do here on the Business Breakfast, the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. This is the week that it all starts to happen. So we're looking at the business of bookselling now on the Business Breakfast. We're joined by Steve Jones, store manager at Kinokuniya here in Dubai. Steve, it's lovely to have you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And you have to settle the argument before we go any further. What is the correct pronunciation of Kinokuniya?
Well, I've probably my Australian accent and slight Kiwi accent is butchering it, but it's Kinokuniya. So Kinokuniya.
Kinokuniya. Where is the health of bookselling in the UAE at the moment?
We're seeing a bit of growth at the moment. I've been told that our competitors are seeing growth in the UAE. The whole Middle East has seen a bit of a downturn, but the UAE is pretty solid at the moment.
Why do you think we're backing that?
Great booksellers like me. I'm not too sure what's happening in the market at the moment. We're revamping the business and creating a community. So the more we interact with the people, more people come to our store.
And bookselling, as we know, has been under tremendous pressure for the last decade plus. Amazon coming in and eating your lunch in a variety of sectors. What do you need to do as a bookseller to not just survive but also thrive?
Well, what I think booksellers around the world have been doing to combat this, because it's not a new phenomenon, it's 20 years or so that it's been going, is, like I said, create a community, do events in stores, really connect with people and be a focal point for social activity. And that's what we're doing in the UAE. We have events all the time, children's events, that sort of thing. And by creating a sense of community, people feel like they need to support it.
And you've been in this game for a long time, as you say, back in Australia. You've worked for Kinokuniya for a very long time. Is what counts as a good year changing? I mean, have you had to adjust your expectations numbers-wise?
No, not at all. Throughout Australia or here, I always look for a double-digit sales growth is pretty much what we look at Kinokuniya. In some regions, that's a little bit difficult, but we're doing quite well here. Australia is pretty stable. There's a bit of pressure in Singapore at the moment and in Japan, but we're seeing a lot of growth also in the US market at the moment. So Kino, we're on the up for compared to most booksellers.
When we think of competition to physical books, people obviously, apart from people buying overseas and having them delivered in, also think of ebook sales and increasingly audio book sales. What impact is all of that having on you?
Well, ebooks have been around quite a while now. Probably we're looking at about 10 years. It's just another form of reading. So we're quite happy that the ebooks are out there and more people are reading. We're not in that business. We've allowed Amazon, and same with audiobooks. We've allowed them to have that. Allowed, that sounds very arrogant. They've taken that business. But the act of actually the physical book has not gone away. In fact, sales for ebooks have dropped about 20%, and paperback books have gone up about 5% in the world. So
in terms of what's selling, what people are buying here, if we go around the various sections of your bookstore, and I'm sure you do, I'm sure you've got the data to track that, what's selling really, really well? Is it the kids' books? Is it non-fiction business books and biographies, or is it things like Not Bad People by Brandy Scott, contemporary fiction?
All of the above.
Which is the sweet spot at the moment?
Yeah. Self-help business books are really going well. If you're going into the fiction area, thanks to the Netflix Witcher series, can't keep that book on the shelf.
Tell us what that is for those who don't know.
Okay. I can't pronounce the author's name. So it's Andrzej, he's a Polish fantasy writer who wrote The Last Wish, which has been, I think it's six books or eight books in the series. And Amazon, oh, not Amazon, sorry. Netflix did a special in December, an 8-part series. And because of that, people are really interested in the whole storyline.
And you really see that TV gives books a big boost, does it?
Yeah, definitely. Movies, Netflix, we can see a spike before the show comes out. And depending on how good or bad the show is, sometimes if a show is bad, the book sells even better because people want to know the real story.
What about local authors? And this is not a cheap plug for me and Brandy or anyone else, but in all seriousness, joking apart, it's the Lit Fest happening this week, officially begins on Tuesday, as well as star authors like Jo Nesbitt.
Thank you.
Coming in, who sold squillions of books. He's a Scandinavian writer, or Norwegian writer. Norwegian. Scandinavians are, sorry. There's a lot of local writers as well. What kind of demand is there for locally produced books, either non-fiction or fiction, if at all?
Well, we're really focusing on some of the local stuff. So if you go into our store, right at the very front of the store, we have a Middle East fiction section. So Middle East fiction does incredibly well. There's a new book by Paul Evans, When I Woke Up, which I think maybe you've had him on.
Oh, we've had Paul on the show,
We've sold an awful lot of his book. Had an event, I think, a couple of weeks ago.
That's not fiction, by the way.
It's a true story. So, yeah, we focus on local because that's kind of the Kinokuniya brand. We focus on the local market rather than international. So whenever you go into our stores, if you go into our Singapore store, it has a big Singaporean fiction area or non-fiction area. So local is very important to us.
Well, speaking of new stores, I understand that you're going to be popping up in Abu Dhabi in the not-too-distant future in the Galleria extension, Al Maria Galleria extension. I've heard wild rumours, Steve, about what you're actually going to be doing in there. Right. What can you tell us?
It's a fantastic store, a double-storey store in there. I've seen the design. It looks absolutely beautiful. It has a cafe in there. We're focusing on Arabic books and some of our really good Japanese stationery. The store is a little bit smaller than the Dubai one.
Is it true there's an outdoor area?
There is an outdoor area that comes off our cafe. So in the winter months or when it's not so hot, you can sit outside and enjoy some nature. And then come back in and hopefully buy some books.
Dubai is really raising its library game at the moment. We've got the fantastic art and design library that has opened near Saffir Park. We've obviously got the giant library that's opening up just across the creek from the Literature Festival HQ, going to be the biggest in the region. As our libraries modernise and get better, does that actually mean less book sales?
No, not at all. The more people that read, the better. So people like to own an item, the physical item. That's why ebooks is not growing anymore because people want to have a library. I think there's a famous quote about nothing furnishes your home so beautifully as a book. So we welcome more and more libraries coming in.
When's the Abu Dhabi opening?
We're looking at end of March, beginning of April, sorry.
Steve Jones, store manager at Kinokuniya here in Dubai and presumably soon to be Abu Dhabi. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Right, thank you.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.